Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. To keep up on our most recent episodes and what we've been talking about for the last little bit, you can go to our website, themacguffinmen.com. Our last episode was about Mank. Before that was Tenet. Prior to that was Memories of Murder, and before that was Us. I've also written a book called Content About Content. My name is Alex Stevenson, Stevenson with a PH. It is available on Amazon, or you can get in touch with me on Twitter, and I will send it to you. But yeah, let's get to the theme song. All right, James, here we are talking about The Towering Inferno. And this movie's interesting for a million different reasons. So, like, the late 1960s. So, in 1967, The Graduate comes out, Bonnie and Clyde comes out. It's this real, like, turning point in cinema. And The Graduate is a huge hit. We've talked about it at length, probably in 18 different podcasts. I brought it up for no reason. But just this wildly creative movie that sort of capitalizes on a type of youth culture, as does Bonnie and Clyde. The biggest success in Hollywood after The Graduate was a movie called Airport, which came out in 1970 and basically created a genre. And one of the more notable movies in that genre, the disaster movie genre, or the disaster movie of the 70s specifically, was The Towering Inferno, which is what we are talking about here today. A John Gillerman film, although I'm sure Irwin Allen would dispute that and does immediately in the opening credits.
Yeah, there's just too much going on here for one director. Yeah, you're right. I think you're right to distinguish the fact that it's the 70s disaster, because there was a little wave of it, a little subgenre of it. The disaster movie has been around, I mean, for 75 years by the time this movie comes out. It's just, it's been part of cinema since they were able to make movies, basically. You know, once they got out of the lab of just shooting, you know, someone sneezing or something like that. People like watching things get destroyed. People like the sense of, you know, suspense and destruction that a disaster movie can bring around. It's kind of one of the things that we go to cinema for, is to see things happen that's, you know, it's spectacular and someone's in danger or people are dying, but we don't have to feel bad about it because they're not real people. So it's cathartic in a way.
And it's so just such a cinematic thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's there's a movie from 1901 just called Fire! Exclamation mark. And so, I mean, that speaks to the disaster movie. It speaks to the building burning down disaster movie, which is the plot, if you want to call it that, of that movie and of this movie. And so there is something very quintessential, I think, about the idea of what people thought they could do with cinema. And this is just that to its maximum, to its most bloated, you could say. There are a million different things that are interesting about this movie. You're right. And not all necessarily positive, not all negative, but this does kind of speak to something that people have always found interesting about what we can do with movies. And yeah, the 70s disaster wave is this very notable time period in film. And, you know, I think you're right to place it after The Graduate. And I think importantly, before Jaws, which is a different kind of blockbuster. But this movie made a ton of money. I mean, a bunch of these movies made an incredible amount of money, and that's why these waves come. You know, something works in the 70s, in 1970, and they try to replicate that formula. And so, with something like Fire, with these really old disaster movies, storytelling just wasn't intricate enough. They just didn't have the tools, and they didn't have the history of how to tell these narrative stories on film.
And also audience understanding of how to accept these things, right? Which is always always growing. Yeah.
Yes, and something that this movie does absolutely well is fake so much of this. Whereas in 1901, to make a burning building movie, you just set a building on fire. By 1974, it's not perfectly safe, but they know about, you know, how to do matte paintings or how to do miniatures. This was still a dangerous film to make, but not the way that it was at the turn of that century. So, I bring up the fact that this was a certain wave of a decade because this one really does sum it up. And you can make arguments for the Poseidon Adventure and Airport, which I think are viewed as, you know, probably the big three of this wave. But I think it's going to be Towering Inferno if you have to narrow it down to one. And I think that's true because it does, it has so many of those features that we come to see in all those, so many of those 70s disaster movies.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like the, and Irwin Allen produces the Poseidon Adventure, and they're very similar movies in structure and just core ideas of how we're making this movie. Like, Airport is the first movie that shows that quote-unquote disaster movies can make these, can be like huge successes, and I think it also got nominated for like 10 Academy Awards, Airport did.
Yes.
But the Poseidon Adventure is where the formula that we know as the disaster movie is just more prominent, where it's like we've got 8 movie stars or 10 in the Towering Inferno, and it's just they're all playing smaller roles than they would in a regular movie because there's too many of them in one movie to give them all the size of the role that they typically would have. Some of them are going to die, some of them are going to survive. It's going to be a very conservative idea like running through the movie. That is something that has never changed about disaster movies. It's just in general good and evil exist, you know, and there's not really a lot of moral gray area. It's just some people are good, some people are bad, some people are bad and then become good, some people are bad and stay bad and are usually punished for that. But yeah,
architects bad, firefighters good, apparently. this finally illuminated that ongoing beef that I didn't know about.
Yeah, exactly. But you
are right. There is this, the ensemble cast, and as you said, they're not getting as much screen time as they're used to because we have multiple plot lines running throughout. You know, we have families, we have a main character at a crossroads usually, and even down to it being the opening night or the maiden voyage or the, you know, first flight or whatever it is. So many of that's, it's there already. And a group of VIPs is also very often found, whether it's political figures or celebrities or, you know, actors and things like that. Those would be sort of the main checkpoints. And yeah, there really is just kind of variations on a theme, you know, talking about Poseidon Adventure and this and Airport and so many of the other films that aren't remembered as positively as these ones. And these aren't really viewed as works of art.
No, not at all. They shouldn't be. But I say that as somebody who loves disaster movies. Every time a new one comes out, I'm there. Geostorm, best movie the last 10 years. Sign me up for 18 more of those, you know, like Day After Tomorrow, whatever. All of these movies that follow this template, I love them every time. And they're all stupid, but there's just something, there's this delicate balance between just really big filmmaking. And usually there's a good set piece or two. In this movie, I think there are a number of them in The Towering Inferno. And yeah, also there's something that I love, which is sort of almost accidental campiness, which there is so much of in Geostorm and specifically The Day After Tomorrow. It's part of the reason why I love that movie so much. It's just like, you don't know whether it's conscious of how silly it's being. But when Robert Wagner puts a wet towel on him and looks back heroically, like he's going to save the day before just sprinting into fire, it's so funny. And it's also like a really impressive scene. And it's just that delicate balance. And it's like, and also just sign me up for movies that feature 10 movie stars, you know, like every time.
Yeah.
So, and that's the basic appeal of disaster movies to me. And I think the storylines, I mean, as we said, they're always the same. But I found a quote from a writer named Nick Roddick. I think he wrote this in the 80s, but it's basically just speaks to the general appeal of disaster movies. and why they've been popular with audiences over the years. Disaster movies are undoubtedly on one level straightforward, spectacular entertainment, but on another, operative only because of the first level, they are consistently and seductively the embodiment of a corporatist worldview, a pleasingly simple solution to the troubling problems of our age within an effective narrative framework. These disasters may happen, they suggest, and if not, these very similar ones, and when they come, you will know what to do. Like, it's sort of the idea that in this movie, you are Paul Newman, you are Steve McQueen, and you are thrust into this situation that theoretically could happen. And the movie shows you that, or gives you a chance to latch onto the idea that maybe you would know what to do in these situations, as opposed to just try and break out through the scenic elevator and end up dying. Yeah.
And
which is exactly what would happen to me in this movie.
Right. But I mean, Steve McQueen in this movie, just that idea of always knowing exactly what to do and doing it perfectly. I know that this doesn't go smoothly, this operation that he's on to save everybody's lives, but I think you and Mr. Roddick here are absolutely correct that that has to be part of what we enjoy about this, is seeing someone, you know, we are just so confused and overwhelmed and we're not even in the situation with all those stresses, and the notion that they're acting as coolly as they do. Steve McQueen was good at that. Acting cool. Yeah. But no, I think that's right of it. And before we get just to carry that point for a second too, while we're still sort of looking at this in the macro sense, the 70s is a really wild time. It's just this very uneasy decade, and there's insane things that happens in every decade, but just the amount of bombings and hijackings that go on during that decade, it makes a ton of sense why that decade has so many of these things like this. And you know, when you talk about the cathartic nature of this, you know, to watch it and have that sense of what it would be like to be in that situation, mm-hmm. but also in control, there would just be so many events that you would watch on television during this time that would have some of the same elements as this. You know, people on the ground, some people in control, some people helpless, some people dying, some people surviving and telling their story. And that's just something that happened a disproportionate amount of times in the 70s. And one sort of last thing in a sort of a grand scheme of this, but we had, like we had in the 70s, we had a big influx of disaster movies after World War II, and you see this particularly a lot in Japanese cinema with the monster horror movies. The 40s, you know, World War II had a lot of world disaster, kind of on a scale that no one had ever really seen. And so while the disaster genre has been around, the atomic age brought around certain fears to the forefront, and you know, this ideas of mutation and nature sort of going out of control. We saw that in the 50s, and in the 70s, we have less of that element in this wave of disaster movies. It's not supernatural. It's not that sort of sci-fi alien landing out of control thing, but there still is this idea that technology and corporate greed are getting the best of us, and you know, we're reaching too high. We're building buildings too tall. We're putting too much control into douchey son-in-laws who will get kickbacks in order to do something more cheaply. So I think that just sort of just places this movie in the 70s and why that wave came about when it did, and why these disaster movies that pop up in waves looks a little different, and why they look the way they do this time around.
Yeah, no, that that is all interesting and certainly scans with me. Makes sense. Where to start with the Towering Inferno? I suppose this is a less complicated movie than the ones we have discussed over the last year. You know, like, there's not a lot of film grammar notes that I took in this movie, like furiously writing down how a camera moved and what it communicates, just because there's not a lot of it in this movie. Pure enjoyment level. Where did you stand with the Towering Inferno?
Oh, I was so back and forth. I was all over the place with this one. And I'm so happy that we decided to do this one, and it timed out perfectly, just because I've been reading a lot about cinema history and visual effects, and this was a perfect sort of intersection of the two of those. But yeah, I think things work so well at some points in this movie, and as you mentioned, sometimes they just veer into a level of camp that it's hard to imagine them not seeing it kind of through our eyes, which is so impossible to do. But yeah, just you had such a good example of it with that kind of wet towel over his head, and then he just tries to run a 100-yard dash to this flaming building. And there are some deaths that really hit, and some, you know, frankly, just they play like such comedy. And it's such a bloated movie. It's so big, you know. It's two books, two directors, two studios, two stars, but also 10 stars. And so yeah, I really vacillated back and forth from getting the experience I imagine these directors wanted me to have to being really detached and not being able to not enjoy it, because I enjoyed watching this movie. I was not getting in the lane that they wanted me to be, I suppose.
Oh yeah, but that's never gonna happen, you know, like, because this movie tries to walk the very delicate line of we're an action movie about something, but, and I think this movie very firmly believes, at least from the Irwin Allen and Sterling Siliphant side of things, I don't think John Gillerman necessarily does, but it thinks it's about something, and it tries so hard to say important things while pounding a fist on the desk, and it's just like, come on, man, we're here to watch people with pretty blue eyes almost burn to death, you know, like, that's what we're here for. And I think outside of those two people, I think everybody in this movie is in it for the money. I don't think anybody else thinks they're making art, with the exception of the writer and the producer. And again, that dichotomy is so fascinating and so fun to watch. And I loved watching this movie. I think it is like, I just go to any point in cinema history and pick out whatever the most expensive movie of that given year was, I'm always going to find it interesting. And whether or not this was actually the most expensive movie made in 1974, like, I don't know what the budget of The Godfather 2 was. I don't know. But clearly very expensive and very 1974. And I'm always fascinated by that. And the fact that even one of Paul Newman and Steve McQueen is in this movie, let alone both, is just, it's fascinating to me. And it never stopped being interesting. And the other thing I found very interesting about it is that I couldn't find anything to back up this theory, but this movie must have had a very rushed post-production process. And I think its release date was mid-December, which usually with a summer release or something that's pushing to get released by the end of the year for to be in theaters for the holidays and also for the Academy Awards voting season. It just really felt like they didn't have enough time to make this movie, but they had to get it done before December 14th. And especially, you can really feel it in the first half hour. Just the pacing is so flabby. And, you know, and it just seems like something where if they had another 3 weeks to watch and rewatch this movie and figure out ways to trim out little things, that wouldn't affect the movie in any way. And again, I say this a lot, but I'm not somebody who complains about a movie being too long. And I actually don't think The Towering Inferno is too long. I know it's sort of, it goes against what I'm saying, but it just feels like there's so much stuff that just doesn't need to be there and doesn't help the movie, doesn't hurt the movie. It's just there. And it feels like if they had enough time to work on it, it would have just been cut. Like the daughter, William Holden's daughter, talking to her husband after Paul Newman has come to confront him about the fire that has started very early on in the movie, when they sit on the couch and have their conversation that lasts for like a minute and accomplishes so little. It's just little things like that where it's like, I get why you need that little bit of conversation, but it can be so much shorter. And certainly with Faye Dunaway and Paul Newman, their intro scene together, one of my main complaints about this movie is, again, I could have done with so much more Faye Dunaway and Paul Newman together. Like, that was very great. But like, even just what that scene communicates, just, you can do that in such a shorter way. And I think they would have if they had time. And I mean, you can't cut Fred Astaire out of this movie, but every scene Fred Astaire is in is worthless. You know, like, so.
You can't cut Fred Astaire out of this movie?
You can't cut Fred Astaire out of a movie. You know, like, he's a legend.
I know. It's incredible that it's incredible and so confusing that he's in this.
He's oh, okay. so bad in this movie.
Then why'd he get an acting nomination?
Well, should we go through the history of Academy Award nominations? Should we go through Cool Hand Luke and figure out which one of those people actually won an award?
No, but it's... Oh, okay, man, so many things here. No. The same year as The Conversation, Godfather Part II, like Murder on the Orient Express is in 74. Mm-hmm. And Fred Astaire gets an acting nomination for this. Yeah. You know, it's such a non sequitur. Yes, so Faye Dunaway, not like she's not a known commodity at this point either. Like,
no.
They knew this is a movie star. Sometimes you see someone early in their career and they have a small role, but nobody knew really what they had at this point.
She's been in one of the most successful and culturally significant movies of the last 10 years. That's, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Mm. It's very confusing. Mm. But there's a few things throughout this movie that remind me of Die Hard. I don't think that's much of a stretch. Obviously, Die Hard is not released at this point.
I think the writer of the novel that Die Hard was based on, Roderick Thorpe, said he had a dream after seeing this movie that inspired Die Hard.
Or yeah, the
Diamonds Are Forever. I know that's a Bond movie, but whatever the novel.
The Die book, Hard. He said he had a dream of someone being chased through a skyscraper by gunmen, I think. Mm. Which is what this movie doesn't have. Like, it's the one thing that's not in this movie.
Yeah.
It's guns, presumably. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, in you speaking about the pacing and the things that might be able to be cut from this movie, it just reminds me of how good the Die Hard script is watching this, mm. just that it accomplishes two things at once, where this movie is typically only accomplishing one thing at once. And that one thing might be really cool and really well done. But just how tight that script is and how you find yourself caring about characters. Whereas it's hard for me to really key in with any of these characters. They're very two-dimensional.
Yeah. They're not characters. Like, if you don't recognize the actor, and this is true in most disaster movies, if you don't previously recognize the actor from something and have a pre-existing relationship with them, then you're not going to care about them. Like, I care about Paul Newman's character, who I cannot name, because he's Paul Newman, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And that's true of everybody in this movie, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, whoever.
Yeah. And that's true that that's not what we go to disaster movies for. No. And that's why there's so many characters in it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Paul Newman and Steve McQueen and the their kind of famous, we'll call it, relationship for this?
I mean, yeah. I don't know. I think I would just be reciting what's on Wikipedia, basically, like that they're both the sort of like top billing. Both of our names have to show up at the same time. We both have to be paid the exact same amount of money. We have to have the same number of lines, like standard dick measuring bullshit, you know? So.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I think that's some stuff that people don't know who maybe haven't read as much about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's kind of less interesting than an analysis, but I think speaks to sort of the bloated nature of this. And I know that's probably the 10th time I've said bloated, but I just kind of can't get around that part of it. Like, yeah. it just seems so baked into what the experience of watching this movie was to me. And sometimes that's awesome bloat, you know. Sometimes I know that those ideas are how you get whatever gigantic check was written for this movie.
Yeah.
But it just, even in an ensemble cast, it's they can't even have the one lead character. They can't have the one lead actor. There's too much here. It's just this exercise in maximalism that even behind the screens, the idea of the star couldn't even be whittled down to one thing here.
Yeah, that's true. I guess the thing that I don't love about it is that, like, I just thought Paul Newman was above that stuff. Like, this is it's like the most egotistical Paul Newman has ever appeared, ever, you know. And it was just I don't know. I suppose I was mildly surprised about that as somebody who has read a lot about Paul Newman. You know, this is somebody who's like, I have a biography about him, and I remember reading a negative review of this biography calling it boring because Paul Newman was just too nice all the time. And it's like, right, that's a positive quality for a human, but I see what you're saying about a biography. But
I think my understanding of it, and you and I are always kind of less interested in that side of it anyhow, but from what I understand, this is something that was more spurred by McQueen, this whole rivalry.
Yeah.
That Paul Newman kind of had a head start on the career, and so he always sort of felt he was measuring up to him. But I did see a quote from Paul Newman, and maybe you could tell me if this is true, because I think it was only from the IMDb trivia, so we know what that means. But he said, "For the first time, I fell for the goddamn numbers. I did this turkey for $1,010,000 of the gross, but it's the first and last time, I swear." So that was part of their deal, that they both get paid the same amount of money and they both got 10 points on it. I don't know that this was the last time Paul Newman did something for money.
It can't possibly be.
Yeah. But
he does have a pretty sterling career. I will say that even his bad movies, you're like, I see why you did this. This isn't a faulty idea.
Right. But I mean, that does sort of fit in with this, that he had this opportunity and he took it, and you know, you and I aren't being offered $1,000,000 and you know, turning it down either.
Yeah.
So I you're a bigger Paul Newman fan than I am, but I think he's fantastic, and I do think it ties in nicely with this idea of how sort of big and irresistible and sexy and a cold way a movie like this is for the viewers, but also for the people behind it. And I think that, you know, you can see why he would want a role like this. Mm-hmm. You know, he's smart. He's kind to everybody in this film except the bad people. He's intelligent, but he's doing the right thing given the opportunity to. But there still is something about the larger appeal, and so I just think that's such an interesting microcosm, because this, when you say that this movie is trying to be about something, which I do think it is in a very bland, broad strokes kind of way, it seems to have, you know, worked its dark magic even behind the scenes, that Newman is in this, or at least in this in the form that it finally takes, and the way that the deal that he kind of falls for, is sort of this gigantic monolith that is the structure itself as a metaphor for the film.
Yeah. Well, and also you kind of look where he's at in his career. He's just about to turn 50. You can kind of imagine him sort of approaching this as like, maybe how many more action movies am I going to be offered in my life? How many more action movies am I going to want to do? The fact that he is doing some of these stunts is very amazing to me.
I know, when he's hanging from that staircase you know, the stairwell, but it's so demolished at this point. Yeah. It just sort of looks like the elevator shaft with some stairs in it. I just kept waiting for the cut before he pulled himself up. You know what I mean? But it's him. It's Paul Newman pulling himself up and doing like a full body pull up. And that's him. And I can imagine why you'd want to show that off as a 50-year-old man or any aged man.
Yeah,
or
woman. Exactly. And it's sort of like, you can kind of see it as somebody just wanting this to be a part of the types of movies that they've done. And again, he had a really diverse career. He kind of did what he wanted pretty much all the time, and his taste was really good. But you could sort of imagine that there was this part of his career where he just sort of didn't have anything going on. And he's like, well, I could do this for a bit. Might be interesting to be in this action movie. And also, I'm the age that I am. Might be good to knock it out. Also, they're paying me so much money. Like, it could be one of those things where he's like, if they hit this number, then I'll do it. And then they hit the number, and he's like, well, I guess I got to do it. You know, because those things, like, those happen. That you know, just sort of scales up. You know, if you're living a freelance lifestyle, which every actor is in Hollywood in this point, and still to the modern day is, you know, there are some jobs that you don't want to do, so you try and price yourself out of them. Like when David Fincher said, give me $10 million to direct the Steve Jobs biopic, it was because he didn't want to make the movie. because he wanted them to turn him down. But if they'd given him $10 million and given him everything he wanted, he would have made that movie, you know? And and I do think that happens sometimes. And I think that's what happens with Paul Newman here. And I think that's what happens with Steve McQueen here. Although I think Steve McQueen's career in general is less diverse. But it explains more for Paul Newman to just sort of say, this is a gig. And it is a gig for almost everybody on that set. You know, nobody thinks they're making art.
And then I have to work with Faye Dunaway and Fred Astaire. Oh, no.
Exactly. Yeah. And you could imagine Paul Newman wanting to work with Faye Dunaway for sure.
And Fred Astaire.
Yeah, I guess. But do they even share a scene in this movie?
I don't know that they do.
They're in the same room a couple times.
They're definitely in the same room. And that brings me to something that I want to get to and that we've kind of touched on just by, I'll start using the more polite synonyms for bloated, but this is just a high budget movie where they get to build and destroy gigantic sets in that one room that you're talking about, the promenade deck up there. They just built this gigantic room with, you know, it's well appointed and I'm guessing cutting edge 70s fashions.
Brown and the orange that runs throughout this movie level.
Yeah, there's just a ton of money on the screen there, and that, there are really good cutting edge visual effects all over this movie, but with this amount of money, you also just you don't have to take the shortcuts, and you can build a gigantic a big room like that and a sort of full scale, you know, big party venue and a luxurious one at that, not just a tent somewhere, but a really gorgeous, ornate room for all these people to these dozens and dozens of people to spend this time in and get these big shots and have, you know, medium shots of two people talking, but then have 60 people in the background. And it looks fantastic. And San Francisco is just apparently one of the coolest looking cities ever. And when it shows up on film, it always looks so cool.
Yeah, but San Francisco movie is another genre of movie that I love. You know,
I know. I was going through some of them in my head too, watching this, and you get The Rock in there.
Yep, The Rock, Vertigo, the two Vertigo number one and number two on AFI's list.
It's a fantastic sort of setting for anything, but just the idea that when he's driving up the hills to see his,
Richard Chamberlain. I don't remember his name.
There you go. Yeah, that's right. Get to see him. We start playing with this idea of height and depth already. And just obviously we get that in Vertigo too, but it is just this other layer that outside of the, you know, that bell tower and Vertigo, but outside of this gigantic skyscraper in the Towering Inferno, you get that idea of height and depth and the dangerous altitudes that we're going to be coming to deal with in a much more problematic way as the film progresses. And I know I was reading about the way that they did the skyline outside of the promenade deck. Did you read this?
No, I did not.
Okay, so all of these, so obviously this isn't shot on the 135th floor or whatever, but they built this room to look like it, and then they basically have a series of paintings outside of those windows, and even to the point that for the shimmer of moonlight and some of the effects of the water, they cut out these curved little slits in that backdrop and had strips of silk hung behind those slits that they would light differently to make it look like it's fluttering or make it look like the water's moving.
Yeah.
And I think it looks fantastic. It's not a cheap way to do it, but it's a way that actually looks good. And there are some effects in this movie and from this era in general that don't look good. Sometimes it doesn't hold up and it pulls you out of it. And it might have been some of the best stuff then, but it doesn't work now. But there are some really difficult things here that are done in camera that I think look fantastic, and the level of craftsmanship and attention to detail for something like that, which, you know, when you have the guy on fire right in front of you, that's what you're looking at with 100% of your attention, and there it's easier to pick out whether it looks good or bad. But that sort of craftsmanship that's in the background that your eyes might not even focus on at any given moment, but you're taking that in, and that can pull you away from the verisimilitude mentally. Mm-hmm. That's something that this movie does so well, and what's something with a gigantic budget, unless it's, you know, siphoned off into a CGI budget on CGI technologies that still aren't where they need to be to hold up at all. That's where that money can go and totally look good for decades and decades.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the going back to what you were saying about the sets, you know, you pointed out the promenade room. I think every office set is amazing and huge. And I think one of the things I love about this movie is the giant sets, the color, the choices of color, and the choices of not using color are very confusing to me, especially given that both brown and orange kind of resemble fire. So like you can't even get contrast there. Those rooms are great. And the way that the cinematography, like just the lighting of these spaces, is very old fashioned. Like through the 60s and 70s, I think you get a lot of, it's very like high contrast and you get some really harsh lights. And I think it's sort of a holdover from the almost black and white cinematography, where you could really push like the contrast because so much visual information wasn't showing up when you weren't seeing color. And you still get a lot of these, I see a lot of it in the early Bond movies, where you get still like harsh backlit, like you're in Casablanca or something. And that still happens a little bit here. And it sort of, it makes it look more obviously on a backlot or on a soundstage. But when the sets are so big and so cool and have so many different levels to them, like Paul Newman's office, William Holden's office, and then that main office that ends up being where Robert Wagner dies. All of those sets are so cool and so huge. And I don't care that it's obviously a soundstage because it looks so interesting and big and wonderful. And like you're saying, when you put somebody on fire, that's going to be the thing that you're looking at. Also, you cannot do enough fire stunts for me, like just having somebody on fire. It's cool every time. I'm certain they don't do it anymore for the obvious reasons of lighting people on fire, but it is so cool. I think it happens 3 times in this movie, and every time it's awesome, you know. And but like you said, having those things happen in these big spaces makes it these big real spaces, you know, backlot spaces, but still real spaces, does so much.
When they open that door in Paul Newman's office, and there's just like another office, and there's more stairs and stuff. It's like, okay, sure, all right, 70s, lay it on me.
Yeah,
hit me with as much weird 70s architecture as I can handle, because love it.
Exactly.
And then he apparently has $140 worth of Vulgar underwear, and I'm less interested in seeing everything that's in there. But
yeah, it was all orange, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I do think the special effects in this movie are very, very impressive. And I think it, like, especially as I age and learn more about film history, I'm more forgiving of the things that look less good. You know, like when the scenic elevator is being carried to the ground, you know, you get some textbook, you know, you can see the black outline of the elevator that they're tracing frame by frame and how it's pasted on the cityscape backdrop. But even that's really cool to me, you know, because you just think this is 1974. This is wild. And there are effects in Ghostbusters, which is made 11 years later, that look exactly as good as things that existed in The Towering Inferno, you know. And but in general, I think the special effects, all of the fire sequences, the way they do fire. We talked about the sequence where the stairwell just disappears and Paul Newman is operating on the jungle gym. Like that's fantastic. The low angle building exterior. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that sequence is sort of the probably the highlight for tension. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple that come close. As you said, there's some good set pieces in here. I'm not trying to say that there's none of the action works in here, because I don't think that's the case at all. But that one, I think you can actually feel your heartbeat a bit more than anything. And there's some things that are shocking, you know, and there's some engaging, I guess, violence, but I think that's the scene I feel sort of the most compelled by for just the tension of it.
Yep. Well, I really like the scene where another stairwell sequence towards the end when Paul Newman and Steve McQueen are both making their way down the stairs, and Steve McQueen uses that like door as a fire shield for Newman. I think that's an awesome sequence. But also like the scenic elevator sequence, fantastic. The water tank explosion is awesome. Like, there's just so much cool stuff in this movie. And again, as I said, they light three people on fire. There's so much good stuff, and the low angle building exteriors are so fantastic. And I recognize that in the grand scheme of things is a pretty simple effect, in that they're just matte painting floor upon floor on top of a real building, but it just looks great. Like
No, it does.
when Fred Astaire shows up and does his very unfunny scene of paying the taxi driver. And then he looks up at the building like that's a great shot, you know? And I just remain incredibly impressed by this film for pretty much all of the vast majority of the action sequences and special effects related to them.
Yeah, so the water sequence I'll start with, awesome. I mean, like I said, with there's a couple diehards moments in here. There's a good bit of Titanic in here too, and that's something that has been around since, I mean, and there's since the beginning of movies, which sounds crazy, but there's some stuff that is almost prescient of the Titanic before the Titanic sinks in early cinema. And you know, if you want me to go through that checklist of you know, the maiden voyage, super expensive, that's Titanic. We have so many of those things in the right in the DNA of the disaster movie, and that's based on a real event. And we could talk about the different ways that the Titanic story has been told, but that it fits in here, I think, is really interesting. I didn't think that this was the what the water sequence is going to look like the first time they suggested the idea. I think it ends up looking great. It's wild. It goes on for a long time without overstaying its welcome and being really compelling. And I think, from my understanding, fire and water are two things that are really tough to miniaturize, and that's the way to do special effects before CGI is to just make it smaller and move the camera really close. When you miniaturize something and then set it on fire or dump a bunch of water on it, that volume of water and fire doesn't react the same as it would when it's, you know, 1,000 times bigger. And
For
so
sure.
it always looks goofy. It always looks like it's a miniature that you're setting on fire or dumping water on. And so for it to look good at all, is a testament to how hard these people worked. Now the water thing, I think they just did it, is my
Oh,
understanding
for sure.
is they just got literally thousands of liters of water and dumped it on these very famous
100%.
people and these very expensive sets. And that's another thing that's so fascinating about a set like the Promenade Deck that cost 300,000 1970s dollars, so that's a lot of money already, that they just destroy it. You know, that's they make this beautiful, ornate, gigantic thing, film on it for a couple of months and then destroy it for the ending. And it looks so good. And then with the fire, I know that to make a fire like that, they would use butane or acetylene, and those don't act the way that burning a giant skyscraper would actually look. And so you get too much smoke, or you get too much flame and not smoke. And so they were sort of creating these new techniques of making a combination of those two substances and burning them and you know, fanning them and using like directly spraying oxygen right into where it needs to have these bigger flames and to have it look more like what we know to be a building on fire. And again, just like some of the other effects I was talking about with the panorama on the promenade deck, it's not always things that you could look at and point to and say, this is how I know this is fake, because I've seen a building burn and it looks like A, but this looks like B. It's these things that you just sort of take in subconsciously, and that's what allows you to be engaged, even if you can't articulate why you're so engaged.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's just about, it's like a magic trick, you know, you just never letting the audience realize that they're currently watching a magic trick, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So. Yeah, and then I think the other big special effects thing, you talked about it a bit, but is the matte paintings, you know, to make a building look that tall, that's mm-hmm. not that tall, you just paint extra levels on it. And so many of those stair sequences that we talked about, just really, really hardworking, detailed people making photorealistic, gigantic paintings for movie stars to hang over and pretend that they're scared of falling to their deaths. And it's, again, going right back to the beginning of cinema, that's how you make things that aren't there. You paint them on a flat surface with very detailed perspective to make it look three-dimensional. And that's all over this movie. And that's one of those things I don't think looks bad. Same thing in Die Hard, same thing in so many other films that look good decades after their contemporaries look obsolete. Is
Blade Runner is another good example. There's some really good matte paintings in Blade Runner.
Yeah, there
Raiders
you go.
Of the Lost Ark is probably the most famous matte painting in the last shot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's, I do want to talk about each of our three non-actor superstars, I guess, that are in this movie. Number one being Irwin Allen, the other one being Sterling Siliphant, the writer. Irwin Allen is the producer, Siliphant the writer, and John Guillermin the director. And Siliphant is just, I think it's interesting to sort of point out certain things about his career. In the 60s, he was this sort of, he was a big name in TV. He was sort of like on the same level as Patty. This is according to Mark Harris, a book that he's written, that Pictures at a Revolution. At the time, he was viewed on the same level as Paddy Chayefsky and Rod Serling, you know, and in a 1963 Time magazine profile, Siliphant is referred to as television's thinking man. And he was just this screenwriter in demand, famously prolific, could turn out drafts really, really fast. And he was always trying to add some sort of message to what he was writing. And his shows that were notable at the time that I know almost nothing about, was Naked City and Route 66. And in the 60s, he won an Oscar for writing the screenplay of In the Heat of the Night, which won the Best Picture in 1967. And then he spent the 70s writing disaster movies, basically. But you can kind of see the idea of him always wanting to put something in a movie that doesn't necessarily exist, like the sort of very, as we've talked around, the very basic idea of like capitalism versus craftsmanship and honor that exists in this movie. And he was the screenwriter of Shaft in Africa, the third Shaft movie, and it tries to be about more than what previous Shaft movies are about, and ends up being the worst of the three Shaft movies, if I remember correctly. And Irwin Allen, who we've talked a little bit about, is sort of this producer in the 60s. He also did a lot of television. He either created or was the executive producer of Lost in Space. And he's sort of this precursor to somebody like Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson, that producing team that dominated so much of our youth. And Don Simpson died in the mid-90s, but Bruckheimer sort of kept on going, and he sort of started to dabble into television in the 2000s with CSI, which is a Bruckheimer show, and the movies that he's been known for. Like, when you say a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, you think something like Con Air, you know? And his name is big as a producer, and that's sort of what Irwin Allen was in the 70s. He made this sort of very specific kind of big entertainment that wasn't... that was sort of frowned upon, but not frowned upon, because like you knew it was sort of less important than something like whatever Francis Ford Coppola was working on at the time. But there was a level of skill to the making of these things that you just had to appreciate. And
yeah, they called him the master of disaster. So mm-hmm. disaster, as we said, it's not a genre that, you know, is most focus on making change in the world, but he's still the master of it. He's really good at doing this thing that might not be highbrow.
Yeah, exactly. And he's in the opening credits of The Towering Inferno, he's credited as action sequences directed by Irwin Allen, which yeah. is it's so in the 60s and 70s there are weird credits like this in action movies. Like there's Bond movies with underwater sequences directed by, and it's just like fancy ways of saying second unit director, because usually in most big action movies, like Paul Greengrass isn't like dealing with the nuts and bolts of the fight scene in Tangier. That's his second unit director, Dan Bradley. And there's an overarching direction going on from somebody like Greengrass, but Dan Bradley a lot of times has to sort of make the physical aspects of these things work under the guidance of the director, right? And you get that with a lot of special effects sequences and or special effects movies. And with this movie, it sounds like they had four camera crews operating some or four units operating sometimes, yeah. Which would be operating totally independently. And again, that sort of plays into my idea that they had to hit a date because they had to just bang this movie out and get it in for the end of the year. So John Guillermin has said basically that Irwin Allen's credit, he's just a second unit director. You know, like I think I've got a quote for him here. I would give Irwin the same credit as I would give the other second unit directors. We had seven units on the picture. All the acting scenes were done in 14 weeks. You know, Irwin can be a bit of a megalomaniac. He wanted to do everything. And in the same interview, that's from a Starlog interview in 1990, Starlog magazine. And in the same interview, he credits Irwin Allen with being the reason everything got done in time and was done on budget. But it's just such an interesting credit that I just had to talk about it because we'll never get the opportunity to talk about it again. And we certainly haven't to this point. And the basis of it is that Irwin Allen wanted to direct the movie, but Fox and Warner Brothers, it's Fox and Warner Brothers that are the two studios in this, right? I think so. Whatever the big two studios yeah. behind The Towering Inferno are, wouldn't let Irwin Allen be the director of this movie, so they had to bring in John Guillermin. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that was that's another thing about this is the two studios just so there were two different books bought around the same optioned around the same time for to be made into a film, and they're both pretty similar about a skyscraper burning down or having trouble, and both of these studios thought, you know, it kind of became clear that they would be coming out around the same time, and they were concerned about box office being cannibalized by the other one. They just said, let's just make a joint venture. And
they didn't want an Armageddon Deep Impact situation. That's what it is. Exactly. Before those movies existed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so one of them would get the domestic box office and the other one would get the foreign box office, which I think is pretty wild. Mm-hmm. But again, I just think that's so emblematic and of this movie having so much going on. And I think it ties into just looking at the poster of this and the cover of this, where you see what we spoke about Paul Newman and Steve McQueen's pictures being on different levels. So one's higher top to bottom, but one's left if you're reading left to right. It just looks so clunky to me. And it just looks like they're sacrificing the idea of a unified vision to keep people happy and to make money and line the right pockets and things like that. And I think that's all over this movie to me. I think that's so much of what's happening here. And I think you're right about them probably having to meet a deadline, and that's what lends itself to all the big things looking still really big and good, but a lot of the small things being out of order or being too flappy or not making the right amount of sense. Like there's some really awful ADR in this movie too. Mm-hmm. And I know that happens sometimes, but it seems really, really clunky sometimes. And the idea of the two studios having, it does feel like two books melded together at a lot of times. And they said they just basically picked the seven biggest figures of two books and just mm-hmm. threw them into one movie. And I think that shows up on screen.
Yeah. Well, and something, it is Fox and Warner Brothers that are the two studios. And it should be noted that it was Irwin Allen's idea to sort of make this a co-production. Like he's the one who talks the studios into doing this sort of unprecedented co-production. And
right.
His reasoning was we don't want something competing with my movie, so why don't we buy the other one too and combine them? which is really cool. Like that's a very interesting and so I don't know. It just seems like such an idea that somebody, like a logical person, would be like, we could buy this and then immediately shoot it down before they even say it out loud. And I think that's the difference between a big name Hollywood producer and a regular person, is that he thought of this bizarre idea that shouldn't think like it work or doesn't sound like it should work. Then he says it out loud and believes it to be true and then also makes it happen, you know? And I think and that's how you end up with movies like The Towering Inferno. That's really cool to me. But the third person and somebody that's still very important in the making of this movie is John Guillermin, and who is the credited director. you know, and I think that, so I watched a lot of his movies this week. I watched four of his movies this week just to make sure I had some sort of idea about his style. And he just sort of fits into this category of what I would call hack directors. And I don't mean that like he's a hack, like he's bad. I just mean like there are a million directors like, or not a million, but there are plenty of directors like him whose work I've appreciated over the years. A lot of whom have worked for Jerry Bruckheimer, coincidentally, making very wonderful / terrible action movies. He's the type of director that just will not be remembered. I didn't know his name until I started researching this podcast. And he's sort of this skilled, if unexceptional, filmmaker, right? And he's like one of the guys who directs a Liam Neeson movie, where I watch all of Liam Neeson's action movies. They're all entertaining to me. I could probably name most of the directors. And I just love them all, but I haven't seen the 1970s equivalent of those movies, but if I was this age in the 1970s, I'd go see every movie like The Towering Inferno. I probably would have seen every one of John Guillermin's movies, you know? And there's not like really much of a voice, but it's still so hard to direct a movie, and it is so hard to direct this movie, you know? Like, what we said about managing... there are so many very famous people who are not used to hearing the word no. So you have to sort of make the movie work for both you as the director and the studio, and also the actor, while making the actor feel that they're in control. And that's just like, I know it sounds just managerial, but that's part of what being a director is. And it's just so fascinating and difficult. And I think that there are so many directors like this who history just forget, but it doesn't make their job less difficult or less impressive, you know, because this movie works. You know, like there's plenty that I don't like about this movie. But I loved watching this movie, and I loved watching this movie a second time. And I just think that it's just such a tough job.
Yeah. I'm always
impressed. Yeah.
No, I know what you mean. And there's all these really sort of nebulous big picture ideas. And, you know, was this going to be one movie or two? Mm-hmm. All these different people. You know, we talked about the McQueen and Newman stuff. But then, and I know this might be in the books that they take, but there's all these gigantic things. And as you said, personalities and these sets. But then you get something as granular as the Battalion chief, the Steve McQueen character, asking for the tenants list because, you know, different materials make different poisons and release certain toxins, and stuff like the way that one of the firefighters communicates with the helicopter with the flashlight. These are such small, like little tiny nuggets of ideas that have to be swept along and not forgotten while you're telling Steve McQueen to shut up, or you know, or
I don't think he ever told Steve McQueen to shut up. I get the feeling that not a lot of people did that in his lifetime.
Not in those words, but he had to have in a certain way. You know what I mean? Like to your point, there's just no way to be a director and let everybody have their piece be heard 100% of the time.
Yeah,
because your day would just never start.
Yeah, true. So the I mean, I guess we should talk about what this movie's trying to be about, even though we've both kind of said we don't like it, or don't care about it, I guess. It's basically like capitalism is bad and craftsmanship slash honor or just having a job and doing it well is important. We see a lot of that with William Holden's character, as William Holden and Richard Chamberlain basically as just the capitalist assholes. We get the real working man, the hardworking American working man hero, Steve McQueen. And then we've got Paul Newman is sort of in between those two things. But at heart, he is this artist and designer. And at least that's how he views himself. It's not necessarily how Steve McQueen views him. And it's so hacky and silly, but you know, I can understand why they feel like it needs to be in there for there to be something more than just, I mean, they have the McQueen Newman handshake, vowing to design buildings together at the end is so funny and so silly. But I think that's sort of the type of scene I love in a disaster movie where it's like, I know a lot of the people who are making this are in on what is happening and think this is stupid, and they're still giving it everything that they have. And I love it. I love that stuff. You know, it makes me laugh.
Yeah. I just feel like they sort of get their wires crossed a little bit, because I think that you're 100% right that there's this threat of, you know, allow these people to have the power to make decisions that will affect hundreds of people or thousands of people, and sometimes they're going to do the selfish thing and they'll take the kickbacks and, you know, not spend the money on the conduit wire and instead buy more expensive alcohol or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm you got me so far. Okay. I get it. It's nothing new, but it's been around for a long time for a reason. It's kind of timeless and, you know, it's a truism. So, okay. I'm still in. It's when they tried, I think it's when they try to weave that into the finale with our two leads, when we have McQueen and Paul Newman as two characters who are still alive that we care about a lot, that we have the most emotional connection with as actors and as characters in the last 2:45.
I could have done with 3:45. As long as they kept lighting people on fire, movie can have no end as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it just doesn't ring true to me, and it doesn't even seem to be quite the same point as no buildings should be taller than seven stories.
It's like so funny. What?
No, it's so insane that that's where we land on this.
There
movie.
Are multiple like short monologues about how skyscrapers are ruining America, and it's so funny.
It's so perplexing to me that didn't get cut out. And like, and I know it. You can't just cut that out because, like, emotionally, I get why that's the linchpin of what's happening and why, as I said, these are the people we care about the most, so they should have some meaningful interaction near the end. But it is so out of left field that it's about building code. And I know it's dedicated to firemen, and that's cool. Yeah. And I never wanted to be a fireman, but as I said, there's some stuff in this movie that is just so deeply cool about firefighting. There's a reason why we've had firefighting movies since the beginning of cinema. Mm-hmm. And as you said, when he blocks that door, or when he uses the door to block that fire, so cool. That's like deeply cool. You know, the gas rupture, smoke inhalation, there's a million ways to make this, you know, sort of ethereal danger a very tactile threat. I think it's super cool that way, but for that to really be the sort of emotional exclamation point on this movie, I think is so bizarre to me. And I think it is such a swing and a miss. And I know, like, I accepted that this wasn't going to be a movie that probably changed my mind about anything or evoked some new feeling in me, because I thought it'd just be like, yeah, okay, corporate greed, that's right. But, you know, I agree again with the broad strokes of this, but leave it as it is, a shrine to all the bullshit in the world. Like,
oh,
that,
so funny.
That is insane. That is such an insanely vague and like I'm 15 and this is deep kind of like thing for adults to be spending such an absurd amount of money on. And I know it's a disaster movie. I know it's an action movie. But give me a well-phrased, simple idea instead of this really like grand sweeping thing with no substance to it. It's moments like this where this movie misses for me.
Oh, it's so funny. I love it. I wouldn't change it.
It is. It's very funny.
I wouldn't change it for anything. I would have loved to see this movie in a theater on like opening night. I think it would have been just such a fucking blast. It would have been so fun. Yeah. Mm.
So. But I guess I'm really curious as to how much that stuff hits with people then or hits with people now. I don't think it ever.
I think this is a movie that people see and then talk about for 15 minutes and then they're going to bed. That's it. You know, like it's not still there with them the next morning.
Okay.
There are other movies for that. Paul Newman has made other movies for that. You know?
So this isn't the shrine for all the bullshit in the world.
No, it is not. I mean, okay, it kind of is. The movie kind of is, but it's like, this is good bullshit as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, how about no more bullshit?
How about? So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin, man. Yeah, be sure to check back next time.